House Committee on Judiciary.
Have your order. Today is Tuesday, April 28th, 2009. House Bill 3341 and House Bill 2537. Well, we are not going to be having hearings on those today, so essentially those are gone.
Which ones?
Which ones? Sorry.
3341.
3341. On the back. And on the back page, 2537. First item of business today is I'm going to ask for a suspension of the rules so that we can reopen House Bill 2802 so somebody can declare a conflict of interest. Is there any objection to suspending the rules? Hearing none, so ordered. Opening work session on House Bill 2802. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2802, you'll recall, is the wrongful death cap yesterday. I think it was somewhat implicit in the fact that I stated I was no longer welcome home at Christmas. But for the record, I work at a law firm that both litigates on both sides wrongful death matters. Also, I have an immediate family member who litigates wrongful death matters. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, for the record, I guess to the extent the law firm affiliation could trigger a conflict, which I don't believe it does, but for the record, I will disclose the same potential conflict.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, my family also has deaths.
Yeah. Close the hearing on House Bill 2802. The work session on House Bill 2802. Open a work. Open a work session on House Bill 2682.
I'm still sitting.
House Bill 2682, the -2 amendments were adopted, I believe, last week. This is a bill that requests the interim committee to study the issues regarding bail bonds and having private bail companies. And we have a fiscal on this, but I believe, Mr. Chair, we're going to move this to rules.
Yes. Members, this was the bill. There was some confusion as to the -2 amendments and a potential cost. With the permission of the Speaker's office, we can move this to rules where they can work it out, and it's intended to come back in the interim to have a work group on it and to clarify that what the intent is. And the intent was not to have a study group that would require a lot of accountants and things that would run up a huge fiscal.
Yeah,
we already have.
You need a motion to move it to rules?
Stiegler, do you have a note that we adopted the -2s?
Yes.
Okay, I do as well.
No,
as well.
Yes, -2s adopted.
Okay. Thank you, I wanted to confirm. Yes. You're my backup.
There you go.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Westnam.
I move House Bill 2682 as amended to Rules Committee.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2682 to the Rules Committee as amended. Are there any further discussion?
This is without recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Wilson. Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Speaker?
Aye.
Vice
Chair Whitman? Aye. Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Okay, now which one is?
Opening work session on House Bill 2853.
House Bill 2853, first heard on April 8th, expanded the prohibition on possessing and transferring a firearm to include a person found guilty except for insanity of a misdemeanor. The amendment deleted the original bill and required a psychiatric security review board and the Judicial Department to provide the state police with access to specific records and information identifying persons who have been committed or have been found guilty or guilty except for insane of a crime. This bill now has a letter from the Speaker to send it to the House Rules Committee.
Well, this bill, again, had some problems. It wasn't ready to go to the floor. And the Speaker asks we move that to rules without recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move House Bill 2853 to the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Without recommendation.
Yes. Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2853 to rules without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative
Olson?
Aye.
Representative
Shields?
Aye.
Representative
Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Okay, 463. Open a work session on House Bill 2463.
House Bill 2463, first heard back in February, allows a person with a concealed weapon permit to be issued in another state to carry the weapon in Oregon. The Dash 2 amendments that are before the committee were discussed last week. The Dash 2 amendments provide that a person can carry a concealed handgun in Oregon if they are authorized in another state, or if another state has authorized them and allows for standards that are similar to those in Oregon. I believe the committee wanted to make an amendment through interlineation on the Dash 2s prior to adopting them.
That's correct. Thank you. We want to change the on page 2, line 7. The last word on that line is or. We want that to say and, so that the reciprocal state would have to also recognize Oregon's license plus have similar practices in granting licenses, background checks, and so on to Oregon.
Mr. Chair, what is similar going to mean? Similar. How are they going to define that as far as how much prerogative they have to recognize similar things? In other words, we know you have to comply with the federal law. You can't have a conviction for domestic violence or a felony and those types of things. And the standards, even here in Oregon, are not the same. The different sheriff's offices are issuing those with different criteria. And as you know, part of that criteria isn't the same. And they've agreed for Oregon, through the Sheriff's Office Association, is supposed to come up with a standard form.
We have some to do. The representative of the Department of State Police may adopt rules as part of this bill to take care of that. So that
Mr. Chair, yeah. I thought there was some concern and opposition to this by some of the lobbyists in the building. And so it's not a consensus.
There is still some concern, but and part of the concern originally was the fiscal that was placed on this by the Department of State Police, that LFO indicated they didn't believe that was accurate. They thought it was way too high. And so it was the attempt to try to move this down to see if we couldn't get it worked, corrected, and come out of it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
I heard the fiscal. I was somewhat amazed. Another adjective besides that. In 2 minutes, Jim at our office got all the information from the states. Now what you could do is make the comparisons. They've intentionally, as I said before, when an agency doesn't want to do something, they inflate the costs. He said probably in another hour and a half he could have emails off to all those states that do reciprocity and have a letter out to them requesting for their criteria, and all they could do then is compare it. I mean, it's that simple. And I take great offense at these agencies that inflate these things when they don't want to do. And also, when you and I went to the academy, honesty, integrity, and forthright conduct, that includes the people that come in from the offices, not just the crew on the road that stops people. And I don't find that to be the case anymore.
Yeah. Thank you. In order to do this, I'll need to suspend the rules and make a conceptual amendment, changing the word or to and.
The suspension of the rules.
Okay, there's a motion to suspend the rules so we can move forward. Is there any objection to that, to suspending the rules?
We're suspending the rules for what purpose?
So that we can make a conceptual amendment and change the word or to and. And then adopt the dash two amendments.
Up here.
One question.
Sure.
Are we doing this because we want the statute to read different for the state police? Or are we doing it because there's another problem?
The problem is if you say or, then somebody from out of state could come here without and have more rights than for a concealed handgun permit. And that was the issue behind that.
With the rule suspended, the conceptual amendment changes the last word on line 7 of page 2 from or to and. And I have a motion with that to adopt the dash 2s.
So moved.
Garrett moves the dash 2s as amended. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. They're adopted. The rules are adopted. And then we next thing we need is a vote to ways and means.
To rules, Tom.
To ways and means. The intent was to try to move to rules, but we were unable to get that letter, so let's move to ways and means.
Chair, I move that we refer for House Bill to ways and means.
You got to vote for it.
As amended.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2463. As amended to the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barton?
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you. Open the hearing on House Bill 2629.
House Bill 2629 was heard first on April 24th. It increased the maximum penalty for the crime of interfering with or assaulting a law enforcement animal. The Dash 1 was adopted last Friday. The Dash 1 amendment simply elevates the fines in both cases. This had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which has been rescinded by the Speaker's office as the Fiscal Department issued no fiscal statement.
Mr. Chair,
I
move House Bill.
Oh, wait, excuse me. Open a work session on House Bill 2629.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move House Bill 2629 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2629 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? I'm sorry, Representative Shields.
There was a minimal fiscal impact, right, on this bill?
I couldn't hear what you said there.
Minimal fiscal impact?
Yes, it's a minimal expenditure impact, no statement issued.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Call
roll, Representative Cameron? Aye. Representative Garrett? Aye. Representative Krieger? Aye. Representative Olson? Aye. Representative Shields? Aye. Representative Smith? Aye. Vice Chair Stiegler? Aye. Vice Chair Whitman? Aye. Chair Barker? Aye. Motion carries,
and we'll ask Representative Witt to carry that on the floor.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Before you close this work session, I would love to state that I support the bill, but to the extent it could be construed to, for example, it has a mandatory minimum fine in addition to some prison that is not present in assault on police officers, I'm hoping that to the extent we are creating a discrepancy with this legislation, I hope we can reconcile that in future legislatures.
Thank you, Representative Barton. Close the work session.
Yes.
Open a work session on House Bill 2094. Public hearing on House Bill 2094. 2894. It's scribbled out here. Go ahead, please.
House Bill 2894, you have dash two amendments before you. That would allow a grandparent to intervene without showing a caregiver relationship if the parental rights have not been terminated.
Thanks.
Peter Diamond, please.
Is she passing out the amendments?
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Peter C. Diamond. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm in private practice. My practice emphasizes family law and related juvenile court matters. And House Bill 2894-2 is a bill that I support. Mr. Nick Drum, who is also in this room today and is also an attorney in my firm, he and I conceptualized this bill at the request of Representative Shields, and we believe very strongly that that it gives needed rights in a limited basis to grandparents in juvenile court dependency proceedings. You have my written testimony. I will summarize briefly that as it stands right now, if you have a child removed in juvenile court, and placement of that child is at issue or custody of that child is at issue, the grandparents of the child have no more say in the matter and no more rights in the matter than a well-meaning next-door neighbor or friend. The only exception to that is that they do get notice of court proceedings and an opportunity to speak from the back of the courtroom, but they can't come up to the table, they can't get evidence, they can't get discovery, they can't get records, they cannot advocate for custody. And in essence, they're spectators in this proceeding. This bill that today, 2894-2, is narrowly drawn to focus specifically on the caregiver relationship requirement in the intervention statute, which is 419B116. You'll see that there's just a very small amendment that we suggest to that. We don't want to change the whole scheme. The one amendment has to do with the one-year test. Right now, if you want to be an intervener, which gives you that party status that you need, you have to have had the child live with you for a year, which is impossible for most people, most grandparents. And so grandparents lose right off the bat. Now, we remove that requirement for grandparents, and that's what the bill does. You still got to go through the other steps in the statute. And it's up to the judge to ultimately decide if you get that intervener status or not. For instance, you still have to show that intervention is in the best interest of the child or ward, that the reason for the intervention and the specific relief are sought are consistent with the best interest of the child, and that the existing parties cannot adequately present the case. So it's not automatic. However, it gets them in the door and gives them a chance. We also narrowly drew this for to make it only good for the first 90 days after the juvenile court proceeding commences. And that, frankly, is for organized, motivated grandparents who really are close to their kids. I know there's a concern out there that you get too many parties at the table, too many people coming to these juvenile court proceedings claiming an interest in the child. And by drafting this statute in such a narrow way, we believe that we satisfy those concerns quite readily, but also meet, which I think is far more important here, and that is the realization that I think most people have. Most people are shocked that they don't have rights, that grandparents don't have rights in juvenile court. That's been my experience as a lawyer, and I think that's the common experience of lay people out in the community. They believe that grandparents do have some say, some rights in the juvenile court proceedings, and sadly they don't, and that's what I have to inform them. And I know that's the experience of all practitioners who practice in my area. And so we would ask that the committee strongly consider these amendments, these narrowly crafted amendments, to give grandparents that that ability to approach the court and let a judge decide, to get in front of a judge, because right now they can't even get in front of a judge. And that's what the bill does. It allows them the opportunity to have a say in front of the judge, and I can take any questions you have.
Okay, I would just ask one. I recall a couple of years ago the Supreme Court ruled in a case out of the state of Washington where the parents didn't want grandparents involved and they denied them any connection to the family. I think it was visitation. I think it was,
yes,
like a daughter-in-law.
I believe you're referring, Chair Barker, to the Troxell versus Granville decision, which goes back to 2001. You know, the statute, interestingly, that I'm talking about, 419B116, came into being in 2001, I think as a direct result of the Troxell versus Granville decision, as a way to balance parental rights with rights of children. And so I think to that extent, this body has already considered the fallout from that law. And, of course, it's still, you know, there's a lot of case law that's come up to the Court of Appeals since then. But this is an area which has been left out. And the other thing is that Troxell versus Granville and its progeny primarily addressed domestic relations court, not the juvenile court. Of course, it applies in both realms, though.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Krieger, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm conflicted with this. As you know, we had a work group that worked over 14 months and developed 10 bills in 2007, passed them all out unanimously. And one of the things that we tried to do is made sure that relatives did have preference when they looked for placement and to be the caregiver. And a few problems have come up around that. I think any of you that haven't been legislators too long, you'll see over time you will have more complaints from your constituents regarding grandparents' visitation and grandparents being able to be the caregiver. And there's obviously a problem here. Now, Representative Stigler and I and Representative Schaffler and three Democrats, Republicans and Democrats out of the Senate, along with Paul Domenes, Judge Brewer, three circuit court judges they've chosen, and six lawyers that do your work, started a work group a little over a week ago. And there's a whole host of issues and problems that we're looking at within the agency, within the process, within the law, administrative rule. We figure it's going to take probably until November before we come back here, before the next session, before we have some recommendations out of that. But what I heard that day, and I would hope that Vice Chair Stigler would make a comment, I was pretty impressed with what I heard from the DAs, what I heard from those judges, and what I heard from the lawyers that represent these families and kids. I think we have hopes of answering some of the questions and getting down to where maybe in the past we haven't been able to get to. And at the proper time, the CASAs, the juvenile rights people, others that we want to have part of that work group will be coming in, the agency itself. But the first two meetings are going to be with that group I told you about. Then we'll be bringing in those other interest holders to help us over the next 18 months. But I want you to know that is going on. And the issue that he's talking about, we're going to take it up if we don't do something with it now.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Representative Stigler.
Yeah, just sort of to chime in there, and I do appreciate that, Representative Krieger. The Dash 2 amendments are actually a result of work that I did at the behest of Representative Shields. In response to when I originally saw this piece of legislation, I had great concern. And I did talk with several folks out there in the arena of juvenile dependency work to try to come up with something that I felt met concerns on that side of the fence. And I think Representative Krieger would be the first to say that I'm not somebody out there who wants to take this area of the law and make it more complex than it already is. But recognizing that, yeah, I think that there are times and occasions when grandparents, and there are other relatives too, who are currently covered under the statute, should at least have the right to ask the court for a position, place at the table. That was the spirit within which I had these amendments, the Dash 2 amendments, drafted. And I know that Mr. Diamond and I have a difference of opinion as to all of the circumstances. I did not feel that grandparents should be elevated above other potential interveners with respect to the criteria that they must meet and that they have to establish with the court, who ultimately makes the decision, I might add here, as to whether or not somebody actually is granted intervener status. And I think it's appropriate that the court makes that decision because the court has the opportunity to go through the criteria and make a determination as to whether the criteria is met and whether or not this is going to be value-added to this case or it is not going to be value-added. So, I, this was fairly narrowly crafted to not to expand grandparents' place in this process somewhat, but also not to give undue, I guess, an undue place at the table to them. You know, it's recognizing that you have a variety of situations when you have grandparents. You have grandparents who are estranged from their family for good reason and should probably never, you know, be a part of this process. You also have situations where they may be value added. So it was drawn up in that spirit.
Mr. Chair, and I really do appreciate Representative Stigler's work on this. I hear the concern about wanting to move cautiously on that, and I think that's warranted. At the same time, I think I just would like to tell you a little bit about my experience, and that I think the heart of this bill is the notion that most of the time, not all the time, but blood is thicker than water. And as a foster parent, and I've been in court where I've seen a judge who couldn't pronounce our foster daughter's name. I've seen our foster son be moved to be reunited with his mom in when his lawyer wasn't even present at the hearing. 3 weeks later, he fell out of a second-story window. He was okay. He bounced just right, but I tell that to you that because I'm very concerned that that we may be that we need more eyes on taking a look at the well-being of the kids in foster care, and I wish as I see the amount of caseload work that juvenile dependency lawyers are laboring under, as I see the caseload of the judges, both of which I think are just far too large to be able to handle this, that they're going to need help. And I think that this strikes the right balance between kind of making sure that pro-social grandparents have a chance to intervene and get some standing in the courts. Again, this leaves it up to the judge's discretion. But I think that what might be a good way to go if we have the fiscal back is to send this down to Ways and Means if there is a fiscal, or to begin the process of getting it over to the Senate, pass it through, and that work group might want to then take a look at how well this is working. So I would suggest that we just kind of use common sense, take a look at the Dash 2s. It's a pretty simple amendment, and if there's support for it, move on. If there's not, you know, I'll certainly accept the will of the chair and the committee members.
Okay, Representative Krieger again, please.
I really appreciate the fact we've had two people working on it. It's been years since people have devoted themselves consistently and don't walk away. It's too easy to walk away from this. We affect kids when we do it. The amendment, as the vice chair said, puts it in the hands of a judge. I have a lot of confidence in our judges. I believe you said 90 days?
Yes.
90 days confines this time. And so I'd like to know what the argument is now.
Well,
against
we'll hear in a few minutes.
Okay, because I'm interested in that.
I don't know. I mean, I shouldn't say there's people signed up as neutral, but it may be different. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question. Is the Dash 2 amendments, is it in some way, forgive me because I'm not familiar with the underlying statutory framework, is it confined to the foster care context in some way?
The Dash 2 amendments just concern one statute, 419B116, in the Juvenile Dependency Code. And so it governs juvenile court dependency proceedings only. It doesn't extend into the broader domestic relations context, doesn't get into divorce court, anything like that. And just has to do with, and by dependency, what we mean is child removal type proceedings, wardship proceedings in the juvenile courts.
Just as clarification, these are situations that may or may not involve a foster parent. Some of them are where, you know, children remain in the home. I mean, there's just a variety of situations. So, but they are, it's exclusively in the juvenile dependency arena, as Mr. Nyman says.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Diamond, you've looked over the dash 2, and do you concur with that? Because to me, the dash 2 looks like it's changed the purpose of the original bill, which was to make sure that grandparents are parties to the juvenile dependency proceedings. Is that...
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnant, the answer to your question is that the dash 2 amendments are indeed substantially different. In fact, it's a completely different statute that we're affecting from the original one, which I think was a placeholder bill. The dash 2 we fully support. In fact, I don't support the original one, which I think modified 409B875. Frankly, it gives full-blown party status right away to grandparents. And I think that I would concur with Representative Stigler's observations that we do need a check and balance with the judge. And 419B116, as amended in the dash 2, does meet that. It still gives the judge the ultimate authority, the ultimate discretion. Let's say, you know, grandparents don't get a free pass. They just don't have to meet the rigid one-year requirement for having the child in their care before they can even file a motion and not get dismissed out of hand. They still got to pass a rigorous three additional part test and in the statute. And you'll see that on the second page. I think it's under... It's in subsection 6 of 419B116, where they have to show best interests. It's in the best interest for intervention to occur, that the reasons for the intervention and the specific relief sought are consistent with the best interests, and that the existing parties can't adequately present the case. It's still a tough hurdle, frankly. I'd personally like to see it a bit easier for grandparents, but it at least gets them in the door. It gets them in front of a judge. Whereas before, if you didn't have the year, forget it.
Can't miss your follow-up.
Follow-up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. But I'm still, we start off in the new amendment, dash 2, and I'm sorry to Representative Stigler, I wasn't involved. And I didn't look at this ahead of time, but you talk about, starts right off talking about caregiver relationship, and that wasn't in the original bill at all. So you're okay with, you know, that part?
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Please.
In what, Representative Wisnant, what I attempted to do in this was to have drafted something that was a middle ground between the current status of grandparents, which is where they can be, if they're not a caregiver, and that part, you know, they don't qualify under the caregiver relationship definition. Currently, what they can do is just be, basically, they can be given rights of limited participation. So something between that limited participation or caregiver and automatic party status by virtue of the fact they're a grandparent. And this really is two options. It confirms the fact that oftentimes grandparents are caregivers, includes that. That can be one criteria for seeking intervention. It can also be if they do it within 90 days by virtue of the fact that they are the grandparent without having to establish that caregiver relationship. So, and in speaking with legislative counsel, they felt this was the best way to, in the best place to craft it and to set up that sort of augmented ability of grandparents to become involved in these cases.
Mr. Chair, I'm a big supporter of grandparents' rights, and I'm prepared to move the bill, I guess, as amended.
So
Mr.
We have some more testimony before we do that. Yeah. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more, I guess, background factual question. Now, having read the underlying statute and the statutes around it, I understand, again, as you said, this only applies to juvenile dependency proceedings. Can you explain to me? I mean, I think all of us have an intuitive sense of what a juvenile dependency proceeding is, probably. But can you tell me, give me a bit of background? How are those initiated? What is the context? I want to make sure I understand exactly what this proceeding is, so I know what we're altering.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, the answer to your question is that a juvenile court dependency proceeding comes into the juvenile court by way of the filing of a petition alleging that the child is within the jurisdiction of the court, which basically means that, the state needs to be involved in the family. And the petition is first met with a preliminary hearing or inquiry hearing where we discuss immediate placement concerns. It's usually within 48 hours of a child's removal or a petition being filed. And then comes a wardship hearing, which comes in about 2 months later, to decide if the child should be a ward of the court and temporarily committed to DHS. And then afterwards, if the child is a ward of the court, and the parents are typically given a contract of services that they have to do, such as drug and alcohol treatment, domestic violence treatment, parenting classes, specifically designed to rectify the problems that brought the child into care. Sometimes it's fast-tracked because the problems are so severe, like sexual abuse issues, that sort of thing. But in a more typical case where you have abuse and neglect, that's where you are. And then you have review hearings every so often, every few months. And you hope that there's reunification, but if there's nothing that's happening after a year of the child being out of care, then federal law requires that we look at alternatives. And that could include adoption or guardianship way down the road.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So who typically initiates these with the filing of the petition? Is that usually the state? Is that could a private party with no could I initiate a petition with respect to somebody completely else?
I believe a private party parents could, perhaps? But it would. I can tell you, it's never done. It's generally these petitions are initiated by a DHS worker. That's most typically where it comes from. Usually they're acting upon an incident that perhaps happened, such as an arrest of a parent with egregious circumstances, or perhaps they've been working with the family on a voluntary basis for a number of months, and it just isn't working. You know, the parent's just not getting it. The treatment isn't taking hold that they're supposed to get into. But that's typically how the process begins, is that somebody files the petition. Usually it's a state actor of some sort, and then the process gets underway.
One more brief follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Would one divorced parent ever file, would this proceeding ever be invoked by one divorced parent against another?
As a divorce attorney, I could not think of a way, of a reason to ever do that.
Thank you.
Okay,
get it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, committee.
Brian Baker, I believe, and Kevin George. Please go ahead in any order. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Brian Baker. I'm a staff attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland, Oregon, a nonprofit law firm representing children and parents in juvenile dependency proceedings. I've been with the Juvenile Rights for 15 years, and I'm here today to bring some concerns to the committee about House Bill 2894. The Juvenile Rights Project, we absolutely support the intent and spirit of the bill. Our agency has worked over many sessions with DHS Child Welfare, with the legislature, to increase access and to support relatives of children in the juvenile dependency system. We absolutely want to ensure that grandparents, for example, aunts and uncles, can step forward, be heard by the court, have the opportunity to be placement resources when children need to go into substitute care, into foster care. Our concerns with the Dash 2 amendments really relate to the possible potential for, for example, for excessive litigation. We have cases where sometimes there are multiple parents involved in a dependency proceeding, multiple dads, for example. There's the potential here to have a significant increase in the numbers of parties to the case, all vying potentially to be a resource for that child. So potentially excessive litigation as those issues are resolved. We are concerned about the very nature of a juvenile court dependency proceeding. The family has come before the court because of an allegation of abuse and neglect. In Oregon, those cases are often domestic violence, substance abuse. There often is a lengthy history, a significant history, and there is familial conflict between the parent and the grandparent. The grandparent has been aware of the struggles of their child, and sometimes to the extent that the relationship has broken down. Our concern would be that with increased grandparent involvement in the dependency proceeding, we may be taking away from the focus of the dependency proceeding, which is to work to assist those parents to ameliorate their situation in the circumstance where the child has been removed, to work to address the concerns, get safety in place, get those children back to the biological parent. There's concern here that that could be impacted with additional parties, with additional grandparents. The agency, as it stands in existing law, is required to make diligent efforts. This was changed in 2007 under Senate Bill 414 to make diligent efforts to identify relatives, including grandparents, at the very beginning of a case when children need to come into substitute care. And we absolutely, as children's attorneys, if we become aware in talking to extended family that the agency hasn't done that, we bring that to the court's attention. There is also existing provisions under 419B116 sub 7 around limited participation, which have no timelines, which allow a grandparent to move the court to have access as a limited participant to the dependency proceeding, to ask for custody, placement of the child, to ask for visitation. And we think that's essentially the crux of this, is that we want to ensure that grandparents, that a grandparent who wants to step forward, where a child needs to be in foster care, is quickly identified, is the agency does the safety checks and makes placement. We believe that that can happen with limited participation. When you have actual intervener status, that elevates the grandparents' role in the dependency proceeding. They have access to discovery. That means all of the information that's shared amongst the parties, potentially psychological evaluations, medical information on the parents. And again, that's the finessing of these cases, is we have to really work carefully in the beginning of a dependency proceeding to bring the parents on board. The agency has used a process for many years called strengths-based planning, where instead of saying, parent, you have deficits, we've identified needs. We've identified needs and a path to address those needs. It's a process to bring that parent along, to help them recognize those issues, to get them working. And we don't want to lose sight of that or have these the intra-family conflicts come to the fore and potentially impact that. That's what really potentially could draw out a dependency proceeding and may have ultimately a detrimental impact on the child. With additional parties, there is a workload impact. The preparation of that discovery, a party can ask for not only intervention, but can ask for expedited review hearings, can ask for a permanency hearing, can ask for custody. There could be contested custody proceedings. And mind you, again, there's the potential here for multiple grandparents to be vying for that child. As the bill, Dash 2 amendments stand, you potentially may have competing grandparents, one who actually did have caregiver status, was providing physical care for that child, vying against a grandparent who was estranged from the parent, has not been actively involved in the child's life, and the court's going to have to sort of weigh in here and try to sort through those issues. As Representative Krieger mentioned earlier, the work group that's formed, we absolutely, Juvenile Rights Project, absolutely would desire to be involved in further discussions to explore this further, have more clarification about the possible, what I would describe as the unintended consequences of the Dash 2, and see where some of the barriers are. For example, a question I had is, are grandparents getting limited participant access? What are the barriers to that? Are they being able to ask the court for placement, for custody, when the agency hasn't identified them through diligent efforts under Senate Bill 414? And if, I guess I'll pass it to Mr. George and questions. Thank you, Chair.
Chair Barker, excuse me, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George, and I work as the foster care program manager over the Department of Human Services and the Children, Adults, and Families. And I asked Kamala Sugar, who is an assistant attorney general, to come with me as we started talking about the finite parts of the law. I needed somebody besides a social worker to be able to answer those questions, so I hope you indulge me with having her sit by me. The testimony that I have had passed out to you is inclusive of, I wasn't quite honestly sure if we were talking about the original bill, the Dash 1, or the Dash 2 today. So it's all rolled into one. So I won't take up the time to go through the entire piece and try to only focus in on the Dash 2 amendments, because that's what I understand we're really focusing in on here. So with the original bill, again, it's really focusing in on grandparents. And one of the primary challenges through the original bill and the two Dash amendments all get into defining who the relatives are, or excuse me, the grandparents are. And it's really important to know that the department has continued to focus on relatives and really values the part of having grandparents. Children that are actually grown up with their grandparents have far better outcomes than kids who are not grown up with their grandparents throughout child welfare, and many other kids in the state of Oregon live with grandparents than they are in foster homes anyway. We only actually are serving about 10% of all the kids in the state who actually are living with grandparents. As Mr. Baker and others have noted, there are a number of statutes that do provide some avenue, be it they all have, you know, a little bit of different take on which statute gives you what rights to participate, but there are some statutes there that I try to point out to say grandparents can have an opportunity to be heard and get notified of court hearings, can do some intervener and have the ability to do limited participation, can ask for custody of the child as well. And so there are some of those statutes that are already in place at this point in time. I would say that during the last 2 years, as a result of the work that Representative Krieger Senator Cruz and Representative Schaffler and Senator Brown did last year with those bills that were referenced earlier, there was a really real strong emphasis on providing a preference for relatives. And I think that the whole intent behind that was really focusing on relatives in general, not limiting it to just one type of relative, but relatives. And so we have a number of children who are placed in our through foster care that are placed with aunts, that are placed with uncles, that are placed with brothers, with sisters. And so it's not just the grandparents that we're focusing in on, but many of the statutes that got changed last session really included relatives as more of a broad scope. And that's where our policy and our practice has continued to hone in on, is how do we change our practice around relatives in general. The department successfully is working with the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, another state agency that we partner with, and have a grant from the Casey Family Programs out of Seattle, who works on evidence-based practice and best practices across the country in child welfare laws. And one of our primary goals in there is, how do we increase our relative placements by 50%? How are we more inclusive of having children placed with relatives throughout our system and not just at the beginning or just at the end of cases? And so there's some work that's being done right now throughout the state on that work. When I get into, I identified a number of concerns with the bill and amendments. Many of those concerns, quite frankly, are really honed in on the original bill that other folks talk about. And so really the points I would like to really point out is that it's inevitable that judicial discretion really is the answer to this, and I've heard many of you talk about that already, about trusting the judges. The judicial discretion is necessary on determining which relatives and or which grandparents should be interveners and which ones should not, because there are cases where it's not appropriate for a grandparent or a specific relative to be involved in this case for a variety of reasons that I won't go into. It's clear that anytime you add more parties to a case, hearings run longer. Even if you're adding 5 minutes on for a hearing, that's not that big a deal. But when you add up 27,000 hearings over the course of a year, that starts to add up really pretty quickly. The primary issue then continues to be the issue about defining whose grandparents are. So even in the Dash 2 amendments, it talks about grandparents, but does not define who grandparents are. And so the reality is, when I look at grandparents, we have a maternal grandmother, we have a maternal grandfather, we have a paternal grandmother, a paternal grandfather. That's potentially four different parties to this case. They may or may not all be in agreement, as Mr. Baker talked about, but it also would potentially include step-grandparents, great-grandparents, foster grandparents. It doesn't define who, if within the grandparents, who is a grandparent. And so that's one of the big challenges. We also have some of those challenges of grandparents oftentimes in our society actually live out of state. And so if they become parties to a case, what is their right for participating in court hearings electronically or other means possible? And so there will be some of those challenges, I believe, that will be a part of it. Again, I'm not the attorney in the room, far be it, but going back trying to understand where some of the original bill, or excuse me, some of the language originated from as far as an intervener, back in the mid-90s, there was language in statute that started trying to define relatives, and it actually had a pretty long laundry list of who grandparents were and who relatives were. And so in a thoughtful process pushing this bill forward, it would behoove someone, not me, from the social worker end of that, to go back and really research. There was a legislative intent to pull that language out. Was there a reason why we pulled that out as far as the state? And is there intention of putting, defining it back in? I'm trying to figure out exactly what the motivation is for that. So going into the Dash 2, we really try to do a very extremely conservative fiscal impact and said 90% of the cases won't have anybody file intervener status. So if only 10% of those cases there is an intervener that files a motion and a judge decides, so within 10% of the cases you have a hearing to determine who's an intervener, and a judge decides only half of those cases are going to go forward as interveners, that then you're adding on 5% to every child welfare case, more parties to a case. And so we came up with a very conservative approach of about 200,000 a biennium. By the time you add up another 5 minutes for court hearings, more time preparing discovery documents and materials for folks to have. I'd also like to draw attention then to, for this committee that may or may not know about it, there is a few other bills that are out there that are really trying to address relatives right now, specifically grandparents. There's a House Bill 2050 that is actually briefly talked about earlier, and it's really to look at separating from the intervention status the relatives who are caregivers, so the foster parents and a non-related foster parent, and drawing a line between that of having non-related foster parents have to wait 12 months, moving that statute back to 12 months, whereas a related foster parent, so the relative, can still get intervener status at 6 months. And so that bill has already passed the House, and it's on its way to the Senate. Is one area to really draw in the relative piece. Again, it's using the term relative and not just grandparent. There's also House Bill 2897, which is requires the judge to document their findings in a court hearing if the department comes in to say this child should be placed with this relative and the judge does not allow DHS to place that relative, then they're required to actually document findings as to why they're not allowing us to place the relative. And so that bill is moving as well. And so I would just kind of point those out. There's a Senate Bill 559 that also is scheduled for a hearing. And it will, again, reduce some of the qualifications within a caregiver and allow the department to actually support more of those interveners joining the ranks of the case. And so I think those three bills alone will provide relatives more opportunities than they've had prior to this time. And it may be that throughout the work that Representative Kriegler is talking about with work groups, that could be a very thorough process to discuss this as well as many other factors in really supporting relatives in general in child welfare law. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions, Representative Shields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kevin, I'm not sure that I heard a persuasive argument about why the Dash 2s, you don't like them, and why you think a grandparent being able to go to a judge within the 90 days is not a good idea. I understand, you know, fiscal concerns are obvious, but But the only real concern I heard is that the definition of grandparents is not clear. Can you maybe try to, again, make the case for why the dash twos particularly are not a good idea?
Sure. Chair Barker and Representative Shields, certainly, yeah, the bottom line, I think, on the dash two get into defining relative, or excuse me, defining grandparents. Again, people have maternal, paternal, step-grandparents, great-grandparents, foster grandparents, all of those. And so if I have, I mean, my personal disclosure, my children have foster grandparents because my grandparents or their biological grandparents live in other states, so they have foster grandparents here. Should they have the ability to go in and ask for the court to become an intervener for those children? And that's the dilemma you get into. So defining who grandparents are may actually really help decide who gets in and who doesn't get in. So it's not broad or wide open.
Okay. So that point, I mean, so what I assume you're also saying, though, is that if we change that, the department, that doesn't get the department okay with the bill. There are other issues here.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, no, the primary issue in the dash two really gets into the definition of grandparent. I mean, regardless, you always have, you're still going to have, anytime you have more parties on a case, you're going to have a fiscal there because you've got longer court hearings, potentially more court hearings, that piece of it. So that fiscal is still in place on having another party to the case.
Okay, so that's your only, that's DHS's only concern.
No, I would actually appreciate if Ms. Sugar could actually respond to that as well.
Okay, thanks.
Please.
Chair Barker and Representative Shields, members of the committee. My name is Kamala Sugar. I work for the Oregon Department of Justice as an assistant attorney in charge. I'm here on behalf of DHS as the attorney for DHS. so I'm not taking a position with respect to the Department of Justice. You know, when we looked at the Dash 2 amendments, and actually Representative Stegler was kind enough to consider some of our comments, I think, in presenting them to Legislative Council, there was a proposal to actually amend 419A004 to add a definition for grandparent. And I would, I want to address that, and then I'll kind of add to that, if that's all right. The first is that in the domestic relations category, Chapter 109-119, there's also the person who can petition for custody of a child based on their relationship with the child, and one of the ways you can get there is as a grandparent, and that definition is that grandparent is defined for that statute, but it's not defined for purposes of the juvenile code. So there is a concern that match, because basically you're taking that same status and inserting it into the juvenile code as it is in the domestic relations code as well. So, you know, the way it's defined in that statute is that the grandparent is the parent of the child's parent. And in that proposal, we suggested that the child's, then it also say that the grandparent's parental rights to the parent not have been terminated. And that finer point is that there are people who've been part of our system as children, and their parents' rights were terminated, but they've reconnected with their family. And now their biological parent, who's no longer their legal parent, wants to intervene into their own child's case. And there was just a concern about, again, kind of what that ripple effect would be on the relationships. Unfortunately, in the Dash 2 amendments, that kind of got tweaked. And it doesn't, when I read on page 2, line 7 and 8, it doesn't make sense to me. I actually was having trouble understanding what it meant. And as someone who's going to actually have to argue this in front of the juvenile court, I would like for the committee to at least be clear on its intention with respect to that. And it says, where parental rights have not been terminated, a grandparent who does not have a caregiver relationship with the child or ward. And that isn't quite what I had in mind. So I guess I wanted to first just offer up being willing to work with Legislative Council to make that consistent both with the family law code and also provide that definition that I think the court, the agency, everyone's going to need in order to implement this. The other comment that's outside of the definition issue is really a policy question for the legislature, which is whether there's a desire to give grandparents only an elevated status among relatives. And that's, I mean, that's what this proposal does. Mr. George accurately pointed out House Bill 2050 and 2897, both of which elevate relatives further among caregivers or people with a relationship with the child, but not above, not putting grandparents above other relatives. And there've been lots of there's been lots of testimony about those different instances where other relatives might have a closer relationship with a child even than a grandparent. Finally, I wanted to kind of further explain Senate Bill 559, which I understand is still is for hearing on Tuesday next week. That bill also amends 419B116, and in that bill, it actually takes out a finding that the court has to make that the current parties cannot adequately protect the best interest of the child. And by removing that finding, it allows the agency to at least be neutral, if not support, a motion to intervene, or in the past, for the agency to concede that it cannot adequately protect the best interest of the child is untenable. And so that actually makes it easier for a lot of the parties in the case to support a motion to intervene, and again, increases the number of interveners incrementally. So each of these other bills also, so I just think it's important to look at it in the context. With respect to the issue of additional hearings, I just wanted to share that the Department of Justice hasn't worked up an official fiscal impact on this, but it suffices to say most of the time there's a contested hearing that with the agency at that hearing and presents evidence or calls witnesses. If it's uncontested, and again, if 559 is successful, there may be more that are uncontested. There wouldn't be as many. But that's not, the hearing to determine intervener status isn't the only instance which I think would create additional hearings. And I only want to point this out just as a matter of kind of disclosure that the having additional parties involved in a case with potentially variant interests, and that's a positive thing in a lot of instances, but there could be situations where the parents are actually not contesting a particular change in the plan or direction the case is going, but a grandparent may want it to take a different direction, and that will simply just add to the number of contested hearings throughout the life of a juvenile case. Again, this is not pro or con that, it's just simply an impact. And there can be some real benefits to having additional voices, and so I'm not opposing that in any way. But the last thing that I just wanted to share and to mention kind of what Mr. Barker said, which is that not only is there, if a person reaches the status of being a party to the juvenile court case, which is what an intervener is, there is additional, everything that's copied to the parties goes to that person too, unless there's some sort of parameter set by the court. And these are sometimes estranged parents of their adult children. There are sometimes relationships, just to liken it to a divorce case, sometimes there are relationships between the two biological parents are very strained, and among their parents and their former spouse or parent of the other child, other parents of the child are strained. And if you can imagine a divorce proceeding with the grandparents at the table too, seeing all of the psychological evaluations, ringing in on custody, I mean, it does expand the nature of the proceeding. It opens up a lot of private and personal information regarding alcohol and drug treatment, psychological evaluations, psychosexual evaluations to everyone's parents and grandparents. So, again, just for purposes of discussion, I wanted to raise those issues. I can answer questions.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be clear about how I'm reading this Dash 2 amendment. Am I right that many of the concerns you all are raising about potential increased complexity, costs of litigation, you're assuming the motion for intervention is granted, and all this dash two is doing is creating the avenue for that motion to be filed. Am I right?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I think the assumption was that 10% of the people would actually petition for the intervention, according to Mr. George's testimony, and that only 5% would be granted. So it's about half. It's just an estimate.
It just as a follow-up comment, Mr. Chair, it just seems to me that the dash two is simply saying, be sure you're checking in with a grandparent, that they have an opportunity at a minimum to file a motion to say, hey, we exist. But they still have to meet all the criteria that are already in statute for intervening. And I have, this is not my area of law. I don't know a thing about it, how often these motions are granted or anything. But I'm not sure I'm persuaded that this amendment really opens the door as wide as is being suggested, if all we're doing is expanding the class of people who can file a motion for intervention and the same criteria for its being granted still exist.
Could I respond?
Sure,
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I think the concern is that it is fairly broad. A grandparent can move to intervene within those first 90 days. I believe it was Representative Barton who asked the question, is this just in those circumstances where children are in foster care? And it's not in just those circumstances. So, the intervention statute is very broad as to what the party is seeking. If they want to be at the table, once a party, in order to resolve that dependency petition, the allegations that have brought the family before the court, there's quite a bit of negotiation that occurs. And my practice, for example, in Multnomah County, approximately 90% of those cases ultimately resolve through negotiation. They're not contested hearings, but there has to be all parties have to agree to that negotiated language, to a resolution of what the fundamental issues are that need to be worked on by the parent. Potentially any one party can say, I don't agree with what the other folks have reached for resolution. I think there's this issue C here that I'm not going to let go of. I have a right, a party has a right to litigate the dependency petition in that circumstance. I think we've tried to kind of characterize all the possibilities. I don't disagree that in all likelihood, we are talking about a small number who will move forward within those 90 days and get counsel and make the motion. In a sense, I think it takes additional resources, additional financial resources away from a grandparent. If they are doing that because they want to be a custodial resource, they're losing money, litigating, where we want those funds there for them to care for the child if the child's placed with them. And as I mentioned earlier, the ability to seek that limited participation that doesn't require a showing of that caregiver relationship. As you review that caregiver relationship requirement, it really focuses in, again, on an extended relative who has been the primary caregiver for that child for 12 months prior to the dependency proceeding or 6 months during the dependency proceeding. It elevated that intervener because of that day-in, day-out caregiving for the child. And I'm not saying one way or the other that there are all sorts of circumstances why grandparents are or are not able to be that caregiver, and it's some of the familial conflicts and things like that.
Thank you. So.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's your intention to move this bill today, I'd like the chance to ask another question or two of Mr. Diamond.
I couldn't hear what you said, but go ahead and ask.
If it is your intention to move this bill today, I would like to ask a question of Mr. Diamond.
The bill may move. Please go ahead.
I'd like to ask a question, Mr. Diamond, when this panel's done.
I see. Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, just a real quick before this panel leaves. I want to be real clear on the issue of the termination proceeding. I'm not going to try and address all the concerns. I think you all raise concerns that are legitimate from, the variety of perspectives we have here, and there's some that are shared by me as well. However, in looking at the language that I took to legislative council with respect to what you were raising, the sugar, with respect to on page 2, line 7, the language that I presented, legislative council found to be much more problematic than it needed to be, and so what they wanted to do was, they asked me, are you talking about a grandparent of a grandchild whose parental rights, the rights of the parents have not been terminated to that child, and that's exactly what this speaks to. So what it focuses in on is that where the parental rights of the parents to the child have not been terminated, those are the grandparents we're speaking of and no other set of grandparents. So if there's been a termination proceeding, this is not a situation where the grandparents of the child whose parental rights of the biological parents have been terminated can now come in and try to intervene. And legislative council, I just want this committee to know, felt that this was much more specific than what the language that I had proposed to them. So then my intent is with this amendment to be very specific, that we're only talking about the rights of grandparents whose own grandchildren's, parental rights of the biological parents have not been terminated. So,
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Stigler, the difficulty there is that interveners currently enjoy the right to intervene into the juvenile dependency case, but they do not. And actually, it's a distinction between the original draft of the bill and this dash 2 amendment. They do not enjoy party status at the termination of parental rights proceeding. However, interveners can be involved in the case after the parental rights have been terminated, and often are, for purposes of arguing about placement and what's in the best interest of them. So, additionally, there's a concern that this puts a grandparent at a lesser advantage to other interveners with respect to that stage if they wanted to intervene late. So, again, I'd be willing to work with anyone who's interested in fine-tuning the language to make it not do that. So.
Okay. Thank you, panel. And Mr. Diamond, can you come back up briefly? Please?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Diamond, thank you for indulging me and coming back up. I thought of more questions as I kind of understood this and mulled it over more. Just as I think some of my colleagues, the previous panel, when they realized that actually the concerns would only apply to potentially 5% of all cases, and even then they thought the concerns might be overblown. Similarly, I suppose reciprocally, I'm wondering in those 10% of actions, why, for example, the limited participation process is already described in subsections 7 and 8 is inadequate for grandparents.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, to answer your question, first of all, I'm glad you asked the question about limited participation. I wished, frankly, I had discussed it a bit more in my presentation. Limited participation is sort of the alternate remedy suggested in ORS 419B116. Basically, if you can't get intervener status, you can always try for that limited participation remedy. However, it's a very, very weak remedy in practice. First of all, those are contested too. You can't just get those easily. You still, and the Attorney General, who was just testifying, mentioned the bill in the other chamber challenging the provision about you cannot adequately present the case or not, and that's one of those hurdles you have to jump through in the limited participation status as well. Limited participation status does not give you the ability to advocate for custody. You can advocate for placement while the wardship proceeding grinds on, but you can't advocate for permanent custody. You can't do a case ender type of a motion where you can say, I'll take the child, get this child out of foster care. It doesn't work. And you also don't get any records, you don't get any documents, you don't get any discovery at all. And so here you are filing something blind with the court, and then you get your remedy, and you're still blind. Now how do you advocate for your position later? Because you don't have anything. You don't even get the court report unless the judge says so. Now, in practice, the judges will often say you can have the court report, you can have this, but you can't have that. Trying to strike a balance, which is difficult, frankly, for the court to do in terms of what people should get. But courts are, frankly, used to doing these balancing tests in terms of what discovery a party should have. But I can tell you that with interveners, and I heard it, I heard some concerns about what if the interveners get too much information? What will they do with it? The courts are used to these kinds of discussions, and the courts can address it, and they have successfully addressed it. So I hope that answers your question. Limited participation, in short, just doesn't make it. And by the way, I also would take issue with the 10% and 5% assumptions. I believe it would be less. But one thing, there's no court, there are no public funds allocated towards the pursuit of intervention status, never has been. I doubt this that we ever will. There's no constitutional right to intervene, and so there cannot be monies allocated for that, so you got to front the cost. And it is very expensive, frankly, to be in the juvenile court as a private litigant. And so, frankly, for a number of reasons, I believe that the actual filings will be less than 10% of the total cases, far less. And frankly, we may even have a net positive budget impact in that we can do some case ending earlier in the process. We don't have to see cases grind on for years if we've got a grandparent ready, willing, and able to do the job.
Mr. One brief, I suppose, follow-up comment. I, of course, defer to you, Mr. Diamond, in terms of how this practice actually occurs in day-to-day life. It's pretty clear this isn't my area of law. I'm literally just reading the statute for the first time. It does strike me on the first reading, however, that subsection 9 grants the court considerable discretion to define what limited participation actually means in any given case. And it seems that if the court chose, it could grant that quite broadly. I also throw out, I suppose, just for our collective memory, if we're indeed working this bill, another possible approach would be to modify subsection 10B, because currently it does say that interveners can apply for permanent placement, but it does not appear to give that right to somebody who has limited participation. And that might be an interesting modification. We could say an intervener or limited participant could apply for permanent. That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming back up.
Thank you.
Or whatever your intention would be. I know it's quite complicated, but
easy.
Slightly. I live with that.
Personally, in listening to the testimony today, I think there's enough problems that the work group would be good to take a look at that. That being said, however, if the committee would like to try to move the bill, I'm not. While I may be a no vote on it, I'm not. I wouldn't object to that being.
Do we have the?
We'd have to adopt it. We'd have to adopt the amendments.
Do we have the fiscal?
We don't. We'd have to suspend the rules.
Okay. And then send it to Ways and Means. Right.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I first of all, allow me to say that I appreciate everyone's patience as I've learned a little bit about this area of law, and this is we really are onto something I think important. And I think I generally intend the support of the bill, support the intent of the bill, that is to have another set of eyes in juvenile dependency proceedings. I am uncomfortable with where the Dash 2 is right now, and I candidly think that this is one area that might benefit from more deliberation and working in a work group type context. That said, we're onto something very important here, and I don't want to stand. I won't stand in the way if the committee once believes that there's immediate demand for it right now.
Representative Shields, you brought one. It's your pleasure today.
Well, I'd like to get it. Perhaps I don't see any downside of sending it to Ways and Means, where frankly I think it'll have a pretty difficult time getting out with a $4.4 billion hole. So I think if this, you know, if the committee is comfortable doing that, I think that would be my preference. If the committee is uncomfortable doing that, because we would have to have another hearing in Ways and Means in order to move it out, be in the Human Services sub most likely. I'd be interested in hearing where the votes might lie.
Representative Shields, I think I tend to agree with Representative Barton that we could use a little bit more work on it. I would say that could be done in the Senate Policy Committee, but if we go to Ways and Means...
Excuse me, Representative, I'm just in talking with counsel. We can't move to Ways and Means since we don't have the letter. What we would do is suspend the rules. We would move it to the floor, and when it reaches the floor, it would get caught, and then go to Ways and Means out of there. That's the way it appears.
I would have the same question.
This is because it's our last day here. These things are complicated.
I guess I would have the same question, though, about how can we... I think if this needs more work in the Senate... Coming out of Ways and Means, it wouldn't go to a Senate Policy Committee necessarily. That would be my one concern about going the route you've suggested, I guess.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Yeah, I understand where we're going. I agree with what Representative Barton is saying with this thing as well. But I do think it needs to be fleshed out more. And if that's the case, because I really do want good policy to be placed out front here from our committee specifically. With that being said, I think it could very easily be something we need to address during the interim.
Chair, Representative Krieger. If we could do that, I'd invite a good colleague down there to be part of that work group while we're working on that part of it. That way he'd be there to help guide us with what his concept is and why he feels the way he does. Okay, Representative Smith.
It may be moot now, but I'll say that to me, it sounds like we're conflicted between, go or go more slowly, and I am concerned about a result that is stop. And I understand it's not stop if we interim or whatever, and 2 years later see what happens. But and I don't understand the politics of this area well enough to know if where the advocates are is, hey, yeah, there really is something that needs to be done so that grandparents can weigh in, or if the perspective is different than that, and 2 years might yield a similar conversation. And I can't speak to the working group. I can't speak to anything that's been happening. I'm flying a little bit blind. But just in case anybody is, in case there's anybody out there who thinks that, if there's a chance to work on the policy this session, if there were votes for that, I wouldn't oppose that. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, even though obviously there's some questions that need to be answered.
Mr. Chair?
Shields, go ahead.
I was just thinking, hearing the impact or the feedback from the committee, and since this would likely go to Ways and Means and because of the fiscal impact not move out of there, I think ideally that we would move it to the floor and then move it over to the Senate and if it needed some continuing work, but I would feel comfortable with just taking a pass at this now, not moving it to Ways and Means, because like the other committee members have said, there's not a whole lot of substantive work that could happen on it down there. So I would be interested in continuing that conversation with Representative Krieger. And the challenge on this is that Mr. Diamond doesn't have an organization, and he's got a day job to do, but I'll certainly ask him if he'd be willing to put in some more time. And there's often, there's not a grandparents or intervener type organization to advocate on for the rights of grandparents, but I'd feel comfortable letting this one pass. I really appreciate all the time and effort. You put almost an hour into this discussion. I think it's been fruitful.
Thank you, Representative Shields. I appreciate you helping bring that forward. A great concern in listening to the debate about sometimes the estranged families in my line of work over the years, I've seen these families really ripped asunder, and I can see where very private information going back and forth, even though it is the parent, maybe the estranged parent, so on. Could be a problem, and I appreciate your willingness to have this move on for more study, and hopefully we'll come out with a great bill either in the interim or after that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I won't be a part of the work group, so to say, please and thank you in continuing the work. There are definitely people in my district for whom, the grandparent is the best option, and think that that's something that we can should move forward on and considering rather than against.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to say I walked in today having only read the underlying bill, not the amended version, and I walked in to this hearing with a deep skepticism regarding the merits of this policy, and I found myself
not just persuaded, but genuinely moved, most notably by Representative Shields' stories, particularly, for example, the child who fell out of the second-story window. And so I, to the extent I advocate for delay, it's because I realize how critically important this policy is, and I really trust this committee in particular, that if we do this right, we really can make a great difference for Oregon children. I really appreciate your efforts in bringing this forward.
Okay, thank you. Okay, close the hearing on House Bill 2894. Open a work session on House Bill 2285.
H.R. 2285 was first heard back on March 16th. We were waiting for a fiscal impact statement, I believe. The committee adopted the Dash 2 amendments. What it did was close the loophole in the drug crime statutes that left delivery of more than an ounce of marijuana for no consideration, unclassified and uncriminalized. It has a minimal expenditure impact, no statement issued.
Any discussion? We already adopted the Dash 2.
We did.
I need a motion.
2285.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I move House Bill 2285 as amended to the floor to do pass. Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2285 as amended to the floor to do pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Excuse.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Smith, would you carry the bill, please? Open a work session on House Bill 3343.
House Bill 3343, first heard on April 15th. This bill, the amendment, deleted the bill and changed the penalties for employees of off-premises sales licensees. The Dash 2 amendment provided that there would be a $250 fine for a first offense when a person unknowingly sells to someone under the age of 21, provided they had taken or would take, I believe it was a training class. The second offense would be a $500 fine, and then the third offense would elevate it to a misdemeanor. We received all the paperwork back. It's a minimal expenditure impact and ready to be moved.
We had the, like, the convenience store people. Now we had the people that were in taverns, bars, and stuff. We left out the convenience stores. Did we do that? No, I think this included the convenience stores, but what we did was they made it a penalty for continuing to have the wrong behavior because there was some concern. They just kept going. And the Dash 2s are in?
They're in.
You want a motion?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3343 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3343 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnant?
Excused.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries.
I worked on this bill some, and I would love to carry this one, particularly if I could give, Representative Garrett or some other good friend the previous one.
Which was the previous one?
That way.
I'll carry the previous one, and Representative Smith, you can carry.
You earned my loyalty yet again, Mr. Chair. Thanks very much.
All in the right box. Open a work session on House Bill 3264.
Thirty-two sixty.
3264, we first heard this on April 9th. This is the HOPE bill, directed the state court administrator to implement a pilot program in one circuit court based on Hawaii's opportunity probation with enforcement, otherwise known as the HOPE program, for the purpose of evaluating the program's effectiveness in decreasing drug use, increasing compliance with terms of probation, and reducing recidivism. A sunset of January 2012, the Dash 1 amendment, I believe, has yet to be adopted. The Dash 1 simply provides that it's not a mandate to implement the program, but there's no funding available.
Sure.
We do have a fiscal impact statement on this. I believe that the OJD has reported that the cost of implementation, should there be funding, would be between $300,000 and $840,000, depending on the number of participants. And these would be the persons affected, I believe, by community, the local community. The exact phrase is community corrections.
So do we need to move that to a place?
This has a subsequent, we now have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, yes.
Okay, we need to adopt the Dash 1s?
We do.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1s into House Bill 3264. Representative Krieger moves the Dash 1s into Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3264. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Amendment is adopted. Mr. Chair, Representative, I move House Bill 3264 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Krieger moves House Bill 64 as amended to the Ways and Means.
Is that with or without recommendation?
With a due pass.
Question.
Representative.
And I apologize, it may be here somewhere, but how much did this cost?
The numbers we got was from $300,000 to $840,000. And we're expecting, hoping for some federal stimulus funds.
Okay.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Excuse.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Spiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Excused.
Chair Barker.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye. Representative Shields votes aye. Senate Ways and Means. Motion carries.
Okay, now you're going to recess.
Committee will recess until 4 p.m.
What committee room are we in?